back again, and Kim McKell has joined us, and Alan Schiffman, and I wonder where we can go at this point. There are a few leftover questions that I'm not haven't quite resolved in my own mind. One for Josh Carter is, why do you suppose it is that disease and malaise can be determined in the eyes, particularly in preference or to other parts of the body? Now, there are people who will swear by the feet that we can find what's wrong with us on the soles of our feet.
There'll be people who'll be eye man and feet man, and there'll be people face man and
finger man,
onks man.
There's phrenology, the bumps on the head.
Why, sure. Now, why particularly the eyes?
Why particularly? I don't know. I don't see any reason why not anywhere else, having equal value. If we look at any tissue, we'll see that it has its message just by the nature of what it is. And the eyes are what see, and we look out through the eyes, and things come through the other way, supposedly. And if we look at our eyes from the inside out, if we imagine the light energy is going from the retina out, Plato's original view that we see from within to the without, we're looking through our whole iris. Through the pupil, there's no change in light. Through pupil, it's just an open space. The black pupil is free space. There's no change. Through the iris, through the colored portion of the eye, we have a whole different experience. We've got holes and colored spots and little crypts and fissures and so on. And these areas, you know, are characteristic for the experiences that we've had in our being. In other words, as we look out in the world, this is in a way the stuff, our stuffings. And when someone looks in from the other side, the other person is looking in through theirs. And for example, for me to see Irving, I have to look through mine to get to Irving, and I have to look through Irving's junk to get to Irving.
And Irving's wearing a pair of very thick glasses.
Thing that you mentioned about Plato, there's a lot of evidence that there are efferent impulses coming from the brain along the optic nerve.
Right.
Now, we've always made the presumption, and I'm going to stick to this until I get some sort of a response out of it. We have always made the presumption that we are receiving something which is out there, and we receive it and translate it. Maybe we're really projecting it.
Indeed.
Maybe it's a three-dimensional hologram, which, interestingly enough, would answer your question, because the nature of a hologram is that any part of the hologram has all the information necessary to reconstruct the entire hologram, which means that the pupil of the eye, which you check for disease, is actually a model of the entire body. And any every single cell in the body is a model of the entire body in the sense that a hologram, well, you know what a hologram is.
Indeed, Irving, I think you can rest pretty sound on that statement. They've done some interesting research at the Retina Foundation in Massachusetts, and they've been able to make some recordings from receptive fields, which are certain fields in the occipital cortex which receive information from other areas, and they're finding that they can actually photograph the retina and the stimulation of the retina in characteristic forms which may be just conceptual. In other words, your conceptions can create an image which creates certain cell firings on the retina itself. And you can actually have a running recording of that.
Yeah, maybe the whole thing is just a three-dimensional picture with quadraphonic sound, which we make up for our own amusement.
It's hard to tell how many dimensions of sound we have.
Then one begins, if you presume that that's possibly true, then you can approach disease from that point where you can say, well, if you're really making the whole thing up, why are you making up a heavy tragedy?
Sure.
Why don't
sure,
you make up a light comedy?
Sure, we're talking about what is our world's view. Our vision, Plato said the same thing, that our world's view is our prison. And
right.
What kind of limits do we put on our world's view? And we must be getting something out of it. And if it's a good time, if it's a bad time, there must be some choice in the matter. And indeed, we find that in almost all states of conflict. Indeed, we decide to choose to this, and we decided that we make it a little bit more difficult for us because we'd like to stay here for a while. Indeed,
so
what would
this
you...
This comes back to the death as birth.
That's right.
Aspect, then. We choose to transcend at a particular
point. Well, apparently, you mentioned that phenomenon of man thing. Teilhard de Chardin postulates that there is, and Carl Jung does too. Carl Jung says that there is a process within the psyche which seeks its own ends regardless of what our conscious ego wants. It's the same idea as when you're in the uterus, you start out as a fertilized egg, and there is some process which makes us develop arms and legs, and which at a certain time forces us to be born. Now, that does not stop at physical birth. Our physical body constantly changes, and our consciousness must evolve. There is no way you're going to get out of evolving. And if you don't evolve, you get a signal. You get a signal through what we construe as our physical body, which points the direction in which our evolution has to go. Let me give you an example. My trip is general practice. That's what I did for 20 years. The businessman who comes in with a cough, right, and he's got pneumonia, and his trip is, well, come on, doc, give me a shot of penicillin or something so I can continue to do the same things which gave me the pneumonia in the first place. When actually what you got to do is stop doing, like, the business or whatever it is. Whatever your life activity is, if you get a pain or a disease or some disabling thing, or as was mentioned earlier in the program, even an accident, it's a message to you, and it's a message to you from the whole universe, which may be your own head, your own mind.
Sure.
There may be nothing else but your own mind.
I mean, I've seen cases of where a person, one a severe case, where somebody decides that that they don't want to see. As an eye doctor, I see people all the time who have problems with vision, and they're closing off their world's view and so on. Well, I had one doctor who was a physician who came to me, and he was having difficulty. He could only see a few fingers in front of him, and he had to stop being a pediatrician and become a allergist. And if you look at that, you'll start getting some clues, actually, already.
After that, he just had skin rashes.
And the disease started to progress. And a number of years ago, all of a sudden, there was a crisis. He started getting blisters and hemorrhages and certain kinds of exacerbations of some non-specific origins within his eyes, such that his vision started to deteriorate rather rapidly. And when he came to see me, I said, well, gee, what's the name of the condition? Your physician, you probably looked at that. And he said, well, we've looked at it for years and haven't been able to determine. It's a non-specific atypical degeneration, which means nothing. And I said, well, when did it happen? 1958, he said. So I said, well, it was all right in 1957. He said, well, yes. I said, well, what happened in 1958? And he said, well, I don't know. It was just a regular old year. So, he looked rather close when I questioned him about some other areas. Well, he was out washing his hands, so I asked his wife. I said, well, he really does have some difficulty with his eyes, doesn't he? He said, yes, he really does. I said, tell me, what happened in 1958? And he said, well, she looked at me in a very serious expression. She said, well, that's when he met me. And then she looked at me again and said, well, and you know it gets better every time I go back east and visit the family. And well, he was totally blind to that kind of condition, and we see conditions like this all the time in our practices. And yet the condition can be very serious. Indeed, how does something like that get onto the structural level and cause hemorrhages and lesions and serious sensory tissues and so on?
You're again presuming the objective existence of structure.
Well, we've got form. We've got created form.
We may have nothing but form.
Mm-hmm.
We may have nothing but form, or maybe nothing but our own impression of form. The practical aspect of this, the reason I'm not saying this just to philosophic gymnastics, the practical aspect of this is that perhaps, even if I'm making up all these people, that perhaps the people who I'm making up, the figments of my imagination, will realize that their own diseases and their own troubles are figments of their own imagination, that they are writing the script, casting the character. Now, that's Plato's point of view. That's Schopenhauer's point of view. Schopenhauer says we're each doing our individual drama, And he said, it's really amazing that all the individual dramas mesh so closely.
Yeah, it's like we're actors on the stage, but not really realizing where the script's coming from.
Well, the script may be coming from you yourself. What you believe to be true, if you get the Buddhist image of the two mirrors facing each other, that our impression of our real world, empirical reality, and that empirical reality constantly reflect and create each other. What I think is going on is actually going on for me. So if what's going on for me is physical illness, or certainly if I'm told, you know, like a patient will come in and will say, which is the bad leg? Mm-hmm. Now that is a command to the physical body to create a bad leg, according to, and you can just as easily command it to create. You know, this was a major breakthrough in medicine. Neil Miller at Rockefeller University first taught us that there are parts of our body which we were told that you cannot control, the autonomic nervous system, like your heart rate and your blood pressure and the functioning of your pancreas and stuff like that are not under our conscious control. Well, apparently they are.
This is a good time to ask Alan Schiffman about the Eastern view of body function. You've been working with Eastern and Western medicine and philosophies for a long time now.
Well, I've been practicing acupuncture, neurology, the general word of yoga, zazen, spiritual practice. But you know, what it comes down to is it's a label. We're labeling things, but there really is no separation in terms of what's been mentioned before. Maybe it becomes a matter of semantics, whether one wishes to recognize that there is disease. If we recognize it, then it exists in that relative sense, and if we are able to, if this observer is able to take one's attention away from the disease, then it doesn't exist. But I think, you know, the essence of all practices, whether it's Western medical practice or whether it's, call it yoga, call it Buddhist practice, biofeedback, it's to bring the person to a point of experiencing a certain inner happiness, inner tranquility. And I think this is where the focus has to be placed. I mean, problems exist for every individual in his own frame of reference. And there is suffering. And to say it doesn't exist, well, it doesn't exist for that one person who's making the observation, though it exists for the other person who's experiencing it. Now, the question is, how can we resolve this thing of what we wish to experience, serenity, peace, happiness, well-being, you know, how can our mind and body be so integrated that we can just experience an inner joy? And this is the essence of all religions, of all psychologies, of all of just living, you know. What whether we wish to talk about it in use of one frame of reference or another, this is where it comes down. You know, we use our intellect to try and reason this out. But I think the work has to be done. Not so much, okay, we have to recognize that a problem exists. I mean, Irving says, mentions that.
Incidentally, this is not my point of view. It's merely
I'm mentioning the diagram, you know, the way the patient should work that out. And maybe for that particular person, it's necessary. Mm-hmm. But now let's go a few steps further. You know, let's get out of the laboratory. Let's get out of the biofeedback room, out of the psychotherapist's office, out of the acupuncturist's treatment table. The question is, really, what is that person going to do with his life? How is he going to apply the theory into everyday practice? relating to his family, to his friends, to his work. How do we use all these things as a vehicle to bringing about a quieting of the mind, to bringing about an inner tranquility? I mean, we can't take a biofeedback machine with us wherever we go. And see, it reminds me, I was in Lawrence, Kansas about 3 months ago. I was teaching some acupuncture to about 5 physicians there. It's where the University of Kansas is located. And we lived there for 2 years, and I was a physician for Haskell American Indian Junior College, which was a very interesting experience, likewise with Indian people. And anyway, but one of the people in the town had an experience of cluster headaches for about 25 years, mm-hmm. and he was about 45 years old. And he went to Meninger's, which is 25 miles away, and got into a biofeedback training program. And for the 3 years subsequent, he had no headaches. He was able to control his skin temperature and do various things so that by changing his autonomic nervous system tone, the headache went away. And then, for some reason this past spring, it all returned. And the headaches returned to the same intensity as he had 3-4 years ago. And yet, he was still able to make use of the biofeedback technique. He was able to lower his skin temperature. He was able to make use of alpha waves and so on. And but it still didn't help. But what he was saying was, he says, you know, I could control the processes now, but now the headache is still back. And I, you know, and so on. There were emotional conflicts in his life, you know, and he would even admit it, like his with his son working on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico and so on. By chance, the acupuncture worked, you know, or it gave him a vehicle to relieving the tension or muscle spasm in the temporal area of his head. But
well, had he just found another way of doing the same things to himself? I mean, he used the biofeedback to relieve himself, but he found another way to attack himself.
Yeah, well, I think that's partly it. Well, anyway, but what's his approach? What's his approach to everyday living that would bring these on? I mean, how can he correct that? It's not so much, well, what kind of technique can he make use of to get rid of the symptom?
Mm-hmm. I agree completely.
And I've seen that actually it's a classical way of looking at it from a Chinese point of view. The Chinese see that indeed you do have to create structural change or behavioral change in a person. Indeed, you can take a condition and you can say, well, you have got headaches. Well, we can work on nutrition. We can work on yoga. We can work on all these physical. We can put you on biofeedback. These are all control disciplines. These are all affecting the physical body. We can say, well, let's work on it from, that's the earth way. There's a whole other approach. There's working it on the heaven way. We can say, well, I've got these headaches because my wife keeps kicking me in the head, or as we mentioned earlier, or I've got this because I remember the last time that I didn't want to live this way, and I've understood it from my relationships with my wife and my family. And so on. This is a heaven way. Through a state of reverie, we find out that the deer says, well, you're doing it because you just don't want to do anything else, and you're afraid to do anything else, so you're blowing up inside out of resentment and so on. Well, you can work on a disease from these two areas, and a lot of times you get significant change. You change the diet, and you do a lot of yoga, you do acupuncture, all these physical disciplines, you indeed change a condition. You work on this heaven way, you do meditation, guided visualizations, and so on, you institute a change. But oftentimes that's not complete. I have patients who do both heaven and earth ways, in a way, if you want to simplify it, and they don't get the change. And Chinese say that, well, we've got to do the wood way. The wood way is that which is in between heaven and earth. It's a state of what is understood as incorporation. It has to be incorporated. These experiences, this kind of awareness, needs to be incorporated into the fabric of your life, into your experience in the day-to-day, into your family, into your relationships with people in the world. I see people that, it's amazing, they so-called experience tremendous insight, have peak experiences with their healing process, but then I see them, you know, getting down at a gas station, getting gasoline, and they're looking at the person, just shoving him $2, and closing themselves off from the community and the harmony with that person. And there hasn't been that incorporation.
Josh, it's interesting. You mentioned one extreme meditation, the other extreme physical postures or movements or improving the physical body. The way in between is the essence of the changing of this behavior and changing and moving to this experience of one's experiencing one's existence. Now, the in between process. This is where the discipline comes in. If the physical body is fine, yet the discipline within the ability to work, the ability to perform a certain kind of action with a certain kind of understanding and so on, meditation won't happen. I think a problem with much of what we're seeing in our immediate society, San Francisco society, American society, Western society, people are doing yoga exercises, postures, and breathing exercises. They're attempting certain purification procedures, and then they're sitting in meditation, or as they say they are. But there is something missing, and it's the in-between thing that's not there, that's not allowing the practice of meditation to allow their life to evolve. And this in-between process involves a selfless, dedicated action without there being any specific desire for the fruit of the action. I mean, I may be practicing medicine, but it's not that I'm practicing it to specifically support my family or to make a clinic exist or make a name for myself. Or it's to serve people, but the work is not to obtain anything. It's just to work. If we all,
are you talking about karma yoga?
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty much an aspect of karma yoga. But it's the action. It's the movement to overcome the inertia, the mental blocks that occur within us, which cause disease.
That might be considered attachment. The Eastern people say that it's attachment which is the cause of all human attachment to a previous condition, refusal to be reborn, because when you're reborn, you have to be a totally different person. When you go from being a teenager to being an adult, you actually have to be somebody else. And that's what we hate more than anything else.
Well, yeah, I'd say attachment is perhaps the reason for much of our actions, motivated actions. There are so many other ways to put it too. How about attachment, non-attachment? To create this activity with compassion for the patient, compassion for the individual, yet likewise, you have to stop at a certain point, because then you're too attached, you know, or else if you identify with the patient so much, the healer will get the disease. Or likewise, the patient has to identify with the doctor so that they can get rid of their disease. But even everyday work, you know, it has to be one of attachment, non-attachment at the same time. And that's the paradox of it. It occurs in that way, but this is the essence of one aspect of bringing about healing. So how many people I see come in?
I wish you'd say not preventing it rather than bringing it about, because I don't think you can bring it about. You can just as easily bring about next Tuesday.
Well, I'm not bringing it about. The person is bringing it. The individual.
I don't think anybody's bringing about. I think all you've got to do is get him to stop resisting it.
Well, okay.
It's very different from
to stop resisting implies acting, and implies movement, and implies resolving, seeing where the hang-ups are and working
or
it through.
Or maybe just going limp.
No, going limp is inertia.
Yeah.
Going limp is becoming passive, falling down. It's the activity that must be overcome. And from that active state, then can become the experience of, after complete day's activity, you finish, your mind feels an inner tranquility, an inner calm, but it came about from all the action. And then, well, okay, and after that, we have to be maybe introspective about what occurred throughout the entire day, so we can improve our concentration
You have to work like hell to do nothing, is what you're saying.
Well, right, right.
But I agree.
That's where...
You have to work like hell at doing absolutely nothing.
Right.
And then you automatically get better. Now, that's been my experience. That's on the basis of this five-year clinical experiment. Yeah. That's what I found, that if you can get people to really stop doing whatever they're doing, and that is the most difficult thing in the world to get somebody to do.
Yeah, that I see. People tell me, well, I have this pain and that, and then they start telling you about their husband and their wife and their children or this, and then before you know it, but they don't want to change their own set. They don't want to.
That's where the doctor's non-attachment comes in.
Right.
In other words, if I say to a patient, well, you've got pneumonia and you've got to stop smoking, and he says, well, doc, I can't stop smoking. And I say, just take your chart and don't come back again. They have to do what you tell them to do. And if you tell them to do nothing, they have to do nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the doctor's non-attachment, where the physician says, this is what I think you should do in order to get better. And if they don't want to do it, you have to say, well, I really can't treat you.
And as there is responsibility in the profession, then the patient again starts to assume greater responsibility for their own condition also. You have a walking ill patient who no doctor won't touch him because he won't be responsible for taking care of himself. The person says, well, I'm going to have to start looking within myself a little bit clearer than I ever have before.
When I did this experiment in Bolinas, one of the things at our clinic in Bolinas, which was the Headlands Clinic, is that it was a little crude at first. Some of the doctors would say, why did you make yourself sick? That was always our first question, was you did this to yourself. You are doing this. You are in full, complete, total control
Sometimes
of your own
statement,
body.
Sometimes that statement, the first statement itself, will totally get the entire catharsis of the situation right.
More often, they flew into a rage. Where'd you get your medical license? Macy's? What do you mean I'm doing it myself? It's a germ that did it.
Well, this is where I like to use the iris, is because the iris actually says, you look inside somebody's eyes, say, well, you don't have to tell me anything. I'll just look in your eyes now. Tell you what you're telling me anyway, and then I'll tell you probably what some of your experiences probably are, and how they're probably interrelated.
How often does that correlate? What breakdown statistically that you've accumulated to correlate a colon problem with the colon portion of the iris?
That's been very, very, very well correlated. What I'm working with correlating right now is working with why a particular problem in a particular organ creates a characteristic emotional situation.
You guys go presuming cause and effect, just like that's the way it is. You know, one thing causes another thing. Maybe nothing causes anything. Maybe we only think they cause. I'm just playing devil's advocate
right.
here.
You're determined to reiterate that.
I'm really just determined to move us along a step. We are all talking in terms of a pre-Einsteinian cause and effect, real world basic presumption. Mm. And that's what's happening in the world today, that human consciousness is going beyond that Cartesian mind-body split. And one thing doesn't cause the other. Of course it does, but at the same time it doesn't. That each one is an aspect of the same phenomenon.
Well, wait. We're saying that there are causes which bring about certain results.
You're presuming that.
Well, I'm presuming it in a way, but through... Can you give situations where you don't know that to be true?
Where I don't know what to be true.
That you see an effect and you've seen a cause bring that about. Can you say that that does not occur?
All I can say is, according to the laws of the scientific method, the fact that one event follows another does not indicate causality. Because one thing happens after another doesn't mean that the first thing caused the other. You can think of it in terms of you've got to switch the microscope from high power to low power.
You can't prove one thing, whether that's true or whether the other thing is true.
Absolutely right.
Why you chose that body, even.
Right. Well, all we have is theories as to what's true. See, now we're getting closer to that. We have a lot of nice theories as to what's going on. Now, for a general practitioner, the theories are all very interesting, but that's just an exercise in philosophy. What I'm interested in is results. Any philosophic attitude which gets my patients to feel better quickly, I will presume. Now, I have found that for 20 years, 22 years, I did cause and effect. And you know what the figures are, 85% of stuff we can't touch because we say it has no organic basis. 10% of that which says... Which
yeah, but okay, but you know that the cause may be emotional or maybe on a different level.
We don't know anything. We only have a theory. The fact is we know absolutely nothing. We know absolutely nothing as to what constitutes our world and what creates disease. So knowing nothing, we have to have that much humility, and we have to poke around for whatever approach to a patient gets results. Well, what's happening now within the profession, a lot of the things that are getting results, like, let's say, Olga Worrell can put her hand on a breast tumor and it disappears. You know, she's getting referrals from all over the country, from physicians all over the country. Catherine Coleman goes on television and heals people right in front of your eyes. You know, what's happening there? How come they can do it? She doesn't presume cause and effect. Certainly Olga Worrell doesn't say she's causing the healing. She says she's merely a channel through which the healing takes place. Now, I think if physicians, much as they don't like to identify themselves as healers, can get back to their original roots and really had enough humility to realize that all they are is channels, all they can do is create a place for the patient to get well. Now, the arrogance that we have to figure out some intellectual scheme by which we can perform or manipulate our patient in some manner that they'll get better, and we are doing it because of our intellectually superior knowledge, is just ridiculous on the face of it. I mean, the epidemiology, the figures, our results indicate that it isn't working. So all I'm saying is that we simply need another approach, just a whole other approach. And the other approach is like sort of back to the drawing boards, right? I mean, we did this Cartesian thing for 200 years, and the results are lousy. So if you go back to the drawing boards, you say, well, okay, well, what did Paracelsus say? What did the alchemists who founded medicine, physics, and chemistry, what did they have to say about it? What did the Yellow Emperor's physician who was theoretically responsible for acupuncture? And these were all board-certified specialists and highly respected physicians who left us a whole system. What I'm saying is...
They made it all up.
They made it up. Yeah, we think we're just the smartest thing that ever happened to the human race.
You know, I've had an opportunity to study neurology, neuroanatomy. I found that a very interesting model to explain or make observations of the interrelationship between a connection of the, higher nervous system centers mediated through the autonomic nervous system, through the central nervous system, spinal cord, through the peripheral nerves, to the various mediated to produce the physiological aspects of this.
Sure, we can trace the pathways by which a thought causes a physical state. That's what I understand you're saying.
Well, pretty much. I think you get into a theory of vibration, a theory of being able to modify tone of the nervous system, being able to modify that into a change in the gross physical body. I think the acupuncture that has come about over the past 3.5-4 years helps to explain disease in a physiological manner rather than a tissue pathological manner. In other words, as mentioned earlier, we're dealing with disease before it becomes an end-stage structural problem. We're dealing with it when we see it as a ebb and flow kind of thing. And the model I'm using in terms of neuroanatomy, neurophysiology, is that we can see the electrical system causing the tissues to contract and expand and cause perhaps specific pain by stretching certain fibers or causing certain spasm because of contraction and so on. So what I'm saying is we have to intellectually, you know, we're looking at disease now in a different way. We're looking at it from as a living model. We diagnose disease through the eye, is what Josh is saying. Sometimes we can just look at a person's face. We don't even have to look at their eyes. You can hear their voice.
I'm sure you've had patients where you know what they've got as soon as you look at them. You just know intuitively what they have. It's interesting. You talked about the model. Now, you gave a pretty good description of the model which we've been using.
Yeah.
Suppose we consider another model.
Okay.
Suppose I lay another model on you just to see what you think of it, another possible model. So, and this is the model of the idea of ki, you know, the ki energy mm-hmm. flowing through. And it's been updated by Inyushin and Aramienko in the Soviet Union. Inyushin is postulating that there's a single energy in the universe, mm-hmm. which he calls bioplasmic energy. Okay? Now, suppose you presume this bioplasmic energy, when it hits the Earth, hits the planet Earth, enters your body through the acupuncture points. It's just another model. The acupuncture points, we know, are points of decreased electrical mm-hmm. resistance in the skin. Now, suppose you know about the electromagnetic spectrum, like mm-hmm. And it's all vibratory energy. The electromagnetic spectrum is energy vibrating at different rates. If it vibrates at one rate, it's yellow light. If it vibrates at another rate, it's blue light. If it vibrates at another rate, it's sound. If it vibrates at another rate, it's X-rays, okay? Now, suppose we presume that a thought, an emotion, and the physical body are all aspects of this vibratory energy, okay? That the energy enters the body through the acupuncture points, where it's carried through a fourth circulatory system. Inyushin is postulating a fourth circulatory system like the Chinese did. He's getting about the same reception that William Harvey got when he said, blood circulates in a system. They just laughed at him. They said he was crazy. And suppose we presume that this energy enters the body through the acupuncture points, where it moves to the specific organ, and then it vibrates between a state of matter and energy, much as light does. Light exists, or electrons, or protons. They're as much particles as they are energy. Okay? So the energy comes in, and it precipitates lung, and it precipitates liver, but every instant it's constantly being recreated. So that if you have a diseased liver, or a diseased lung, under this model, we would not presume that you have a lung or a liver that you were born with and grows and changes, that you must recreate this liver or lung or physical body every instant, every split second, you're constantly recreating it, okay? The vibratory energy crystallizing into matter.
Persistence.
Resonance, actually, resonating between energy and matter. It's constantly bouncing back and forth. Now, the shape of your physical organism depends on the wave pattern of the energy as it enters your body. Now, your mind, your thinking process is an energy source. If your thinking is harmonic with the state of the universe, and that's, you know, like energy coming in from exploding galaxies, energy coming in from the sun, energy coming in from the quasars, which are hitting the Earth, which make a resultant pattern. And that pattern is creating our bodies. If our thinking process is disharmonic with that basic pattern of the universe, which is changing every instant, you get standing waves. And standing waves precipitates as pathologic matter.
What would be the solution then, since we are trying to heal the whole person in that framework? How are they going to relate to the sun, moon, and stars?
Oh, you got to know what season it is.
We know what season. I mean, in Russia, they're going to wear warm clothing in the winter.
I'm not talking about wearing warm clothing.
But
I'm talking about the activities that one does on July 25th and thinking that on September 26th you can do what you were doing on July 25th. See? That you know, to stay in the swing and keep on moving, that's a particularly Western thing. That we presume that we can continue our activities and not realize, let's say, that September 23rd, the fact that the day and night cycle were exactly balanced, and now that we're shifting over to where the nights are longer than the days, is something that requires that we change our life activity pattern, even change our thinking pattern. Insofar as we don't, we become disharmonic with it.
I think that's important.
Well, that's the Chinese thing, isn't it?
And as much as we do, we actually continue. We're not actually in a state of persistence. In a state of balance with the law, we actually have, in a way, transcended the law. We're jumping off the wheel.
How do you mean jumping off the wheel?
Well, as we are in balance with the laws of change, if we say, well, now we're switching into a different vibratory pattern. Now we now have different energies available on the cellular level.
That's right.
This isn't going to pose a limitation in our physical body. We're going to maintain, but we're also going to not experience any limitation by the by any vibratory change that we're experiencing, even though we may be adapting to an entirely different way of activity, entirely different way of consciousness or mode of living.
I think what we can choose to do as humans with our higher consciousness is to deliberately ignore the seasonal changes or the time of day changes or our own circadian rhythms, the rhythms of every cell in our body. There is no place in our entire medical system to account for that. I mean, operations are performed on night people in the morning because it's convenient for the surgeon. I think that was mentioned before. Mm-hmm. The fact is that the body is constantly changing, and that perhaps what we call disease is merely a signal through the body that our thinking pattern is disharmonic. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we should be looking into, well, what is it trying to tell me? In what way am I being disharmonic?
I think a good way of seeing that is saying, well, what energy is available to the cells? Looking at a physical body, what is available on the cellular level? And there may be tremendous forms of energies that are beyond, say, nutrition or vibration, beyond sound or light, that are available on the cellular level.
Oh, I would presume in a universe which consists of several hundred billion galaxies like ours, there must be a lot of energies that are coming in. We have reached the point on this planet, we humans on this planet, think we can ignore the rest of the universe. Used to be that terms like cosmic, universal energies, and in many circles they're still considered occult terms. Mm-hmm. You know, most of our Western thinking is on a very provincial level.
It's going away from the outside energies, all the energies coming in from the universe. It gets too big for me to handle.
All right, well, let's bring it down to
coming back to, like we have Kim McKell here, and I know that Kim has done a lot of work in Jungian psychology and archetypes and dreams and so forth, and the relationship between the unconscious and the conscious and the healing process. And I'm wondering if you could share with us, Kim, your thoughts about that and how the unconscious certainly has an effect.
Yes, I would say that. Of course, people come to me for, again, being a psychologist, not specifically with a complaint. And of course, as a psychologist, I never give prescriptions. I never say, well, this is what you should do. That's just absolutely not done. So it's quite different than this whole medical program. And essentially, I'm a transpersonal psychologist. I have a Jungian background. I use some Reichian ideas because I do the psychophysical. And of course, I use meditation and mantra. But essentially, what I try to do is to have people find their inner core, who they really are, and to get the unconscious with the conscious. And this disease, let's say headaches, things like that, are very valuable symptoms, as we've discussed here, and suffering indeed is. And suffering, Jung was very strong on this, that suffering is one of the ways that tell you that you're not, or the things that you have to learn to cope with life. To cope with suffering is to cope with life. And so it's a coping thing to deal with. And also in my thing, I'm very much pro-agony, because no agony, no ecstasy. And so this is, of course, I come from a tantric place, too. I don't come from the more ascetic, yogic type traditions. And so it's the fullness of life that I'm trying to get to help people get into. And the main thing, the unconscious block that would have to do with sickness is what we call the shadow, is what you don't like or what you hate or what you despise or can't stand or gives you a headache every time you see it or all those people that are wrong. And that is to be found in yourself. The best way to find the shadow in Jungian psychology is what you don't like in other people. And I would say the shadow is what causes, of course, distress. Another big source of distress I work with a lot is the animus and the anima, or the masculine part of a woman and the feminine part of a man, to get beyond sex roles. Because I find that sex roles cause people a lot of disharmony. They try to be something they're not. If men are not supposed to be poets, and you're a man and you're poetic, then you try not to be poetic. You try to be a businessman. In other words, you try to be something you're not. Same thing with a woman. If it's not fashionable for a woman to be a good lawyer, then she doesn't go into law. And she's resentful about it. And then that can cause all kinds of things. So the thing is, to the sexual, get beyond the sexual roles, then also to communicate sexually. You have to get beyond sexual roles. And so that and the shadow, the dislikes, are what... And then why live once you get through all that? What's the point of it all? That's the next question that I deal with. And when you sort of really can figure out why you want to try this game anyhow, that's when you're really starting to get down the nitty-gritty and getting over into the transpersonal, once you handled all this personal stuff. So disease comes now and again along the way, but as I said, it's usually to dealing with a particular place along the way, a particular shadow problem. And it sort of takes care of itself as the shadow problem gets released.
I like that image of disease as the shadow, and as the shadow really does know, and that,
and that when the shadow knows what he collects in the hearts of men, he does.
if you look at the shadow, that in a way you say you look for suffering in a way that you're sometimes happy when you find suffering.
Yes,
because I really like that, in that it gives a beautiful way of looking at the truth. The wisdom that I understand, that there is no such thing as disease, that all we have is various forms of support, and we have positive support, and the sun goes up and the sun goes down, and we all look beautiful here tonight, and ubladi.
Maybe the whole thing is just perfect. Maybe there isn't anything wrong.
But the suffering I find is really very good, because so many people get off of their horse or whatever game they're riding, which is so inauthentic. What a lot of people in their lives are being inauthentic. Because of roles, as I said, sex roles or professional roles or whatever. But it's an inauthentic place to do with their heart.
Like sitting on a tack.
Yes, and even more, like karmically, inauthentic. And the suffering will make them, all right, now pay attention and stop your game, you know, if you're really hurting. You'll come off of it and come into where you can really be reached.
Gives you support, only it's a form of negative support, but...
Or breaking down the support system, I think. I'd like to see a person, it's part of surrender. Mm-hmm. It's part of coming off of all the sham. And, of course, roles are sham, too, to a large extent.
Well, when you make someone give up this thing that they are suffering with, do you attempt to bring a clarification of something that they should then reach for or find? I mean, if they're
usually
going to give up a disease...
Like, let's say an alcoholic that is suffering, and poor me, you know, that's called in transactional analysis a poor me trip. I can't help it. The world is too rough. My mother didn't treat me right. And, you know, you can do a Freudian number and go back to why you're doing the symptom now was because your mother told you how to do it when you were went. But so what? You're doing it now. Okay, well, now, if you just blow that symptomatology that you're choosing to do it, and what's the goodie? There's always a goodie in something,
right.
As somebody mentioned before. What's the goodie?
What's the payoff?
Yeah, the sympathy probably in this case or something like that. Okay, why all this? It all again gets down to a pretense. It's a negative game to get sympathy because that makes you inferior, right, to whoever is giving you the sympathy. And so it's a debasing game. It's a self-debasement. Okay, what's the goodie in self-debasement? Why do you want to be self-debased?
Why do you
maybe,
want to have pneumonia? Why do
maybe
you want
that's the only way you can get love and approval. From way back when. So what you find underneath all the garbage is a goodie. You don't have to propose a goodie. You'll find a very healthy, good thing underneath all that. And then the thing is to develop it.
It's a compost pile.
Yeah. With gold at the bottom. Yeah.
Well, that's the alchemical premise, that the compost pile is the gold.
But it's the work to get through that. And it's hard. It's really tough. It's sometimes a very tough therapist.
Tough as you decide it's going to be.
Well, yeah. So often you treat someone or help someone get over one problem, and then they discover a new
one.
You know.
Of course, yes.
And that's what I meant. To
unless you find out the reason, the actual reason in terms of the shadow. Unless you can get the businessman to admit that's what's giving him his cluster headaches. Let's use that. Is the poet within him that will be recognized and will continue to kick him in the head until such time as he sits down and writes some poetry. Now it's the.
But it takes time. It's just like doing a painting.
I can do it with my patients. I've done it with patients in 25 minutes.
Reconstructed a personality?
Absolutely, total reconstruction. I'm a general practitioner. I haven't got time to fool around a long time.
Well,
I'm looking for a method which works quickly and right away. And there, you know, we're in the middle of a medical emergency. There is a crisis. We haven't got, and this is no disrespect to what you're doing, just from where I'm coming from, that I would like to see. I'd like to see my patients get better within 3 or 4 hours of treatment. And I'm just telling you flat out that 85% of them do. And I use Jung's method. I mean, just to, the pictures that they make in their head, of course, are the shadow. I mean, if there's a man, you know, I just ask him to visualize something, anything, and if it's a male, and I always ask him, is it a male or a female? That way I know if I'm dealing with an anima, animus, mm-hmm. or with a shadow. Just what part of themselves are they repressing? The shadow is usually the basic animal creature, right? And they repress that because nice people don't do that. Nice people just vomit, you know, or get ulcers. So what you can do, that the picture, now we're down to the visual image which spontaneously appears in people's heads. Just the visual image which spontaneously appears. that actually carries the message. And if they can talk to that thing, and this is straight Jung, mm-hmm. the creature in their imagination will actually tell them what they're doing.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is not just your 25-minute get well about, let's say, that headache or something else. What I'm trying to do is, you know, like have a person know, like I use astrology charts. It's to know their whole karmic pattern, where they're going to go, why they're doing, it's a whole, like a painting. I'm also a painter, and it takes a long time to put a painting together. You know, it's a really complete, I'm not trying to cure one symptom. I'm trying to evolve the personality.
Be nice to evolve it in 4 hours or 25 minutes, wouldn't it? I mean, why would presume that it has to take a long time? Why would we make that presumption?
Because it's so complex. There's so many, many, many...
That's a presumption. You know, I'm not saying that you're wrong.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that you're wrong, but I'm saying that I think it behooves certainly me as a physician to find something simple and fast.
Yeah, I would be for it, but I'm just saying there's a whole work of art that I'm sort of interested in evolving.
I don't knock that at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear what you're saying.
Irving, what about the follow-up on these people after the big 25 minutes?
We have some cases that we followed up. You know, that's the
six
next...
6 months later, 8 months later.
Yeah, that's the next phase that we're into now. Now we've got to do long-term follow-ups, like they do with cancer patients. How many five-year cures do you have, 10-year cures? Jung suggests that this is once you establish a dialogue. See, if you want to go into the split brain thing, which is a whole other thing, you know, where we have two separate sides of our brain. One side is male and one side is female. And this visual image trip is a way in which you can get the two sides of your brain talking to each other. See? And once you establish that dialogue, whenever a symptom comes up, if the person has the technique of speaking to the repressed part of themselves, which is actually causing the symptom, you have a constantly ongoing dialogue. And you've got to sort of make a truce. You start out with a truce. Sort of Henry Kissinger style.
What if the tape starts to get a little bit worn out? Is it running
what tape?
The little cassette dialogue that is programmed into the consciousness. Whereas what you're saying is that the person has the vehicle to set up that cosmic telephone line and they...
It's like the kingdom is within, somebody said.
And they make a beautiful cassette of it, and the cassette worked really good on 25 minutes, and now they've been able to take care of their condition quite adequately, and they keep that tape running.
Well, you can't keep the same tape running, because every time you dream up this figure, it doesn't always tell you the same thing. The figure is autonomous.
Well, a person in that state doesn't always know, indeed, what they ought to always be doing next, or what naturally flows next.
The imaginary figure that you make up tells you what to do next. It tells you what to do. It's as though you're talking to a real person. I mean, this hallucination, like this lady that saw a deer appear in the field. Now, let me just ring back what I'm saying. You go into an alpha state, you imagine yourself in a beautiful space, and you look around for a living creature. And then you say, are you causing my symptoms? This is the simple technique.
Mm-hmm.
Are you causing my symptoms? And we must have 1,500, 2,000 cases.
And they're continually creating, say, a psychobiological fantasy.
Psychobiological fantasy. Psychobiological fantasy. It's like a 10-syllable word. That's like meaningless.
Well,
it doesn't mean anything to me.
Well, they're like perpetuating that same state of consciousness. And in other words, for them to be in a state of avoiding their persistence of, say, a thrombophlebitis, that they've got to keep this state of keeping the deer, getting the message pretty clear. And
you've got to consult with the deer. I have my patients consult with the deer 15 minutes a day, which is much cheaper than consulting with an analyst. And the advice is usually much better, because the answer is coming out of the patient's own psyche,
mm-hmm.
which
I guess,
where the problem is.
I guess what we're lamenting is that... is that we're not always getting people who decide to continue doing that. In other words, to do that, I'd have to kick out a lot of my patients, and perhaps I should be kicking out a lot more patients than I
always kicked out patients who did not follow my advice. I do not concern myself with patients who don't do what I tell them to do. And if I get a patient, if I tell somebody, okay, I want you to talk to the deer or to the butterfly or to the lion.
Or the dinosaur.
Or the dinosaur. Yeah, see, now the figures or the unicorn.
Gentlemen, my little deer has come into this beautiful space and tells me we should take a break and let people know that they're listening to New Dimensions on KQED FM in San Francisco. And I think maybe we should do a little exchanging here. We have another guest, Khalid Al-Faqi, who's a chiropractor and into the healing arts and Sufic studies. And we'd like to have him join us, and we'd like to bring Ralph Metzner back. And we'd also like to somewhere along the evening open up the phone lines so that our listeners can consult with all of you.
Great.
And maybe a little music now, and maybe some conscious news.
Conscious News, a feature of New Dimensions Radio, presenting those developments which affect personal and planetary consciousness change.
Acupuncture, a healing system that has implications beyond the physical, is now legal. California Bill SB 89 was passed into law this past summer by Governor Brown. The Chinese form of medicine, acupuncture, can now be practiced by medical practitioners without fear of legal ramifications. Acupuncture, of course, has been used in China as part of a holistic approach to medicine involving consciousness change for centuries. It is now gaining widespread acceptance among the professional and establishment sectors of the United States. Also involving the establishment, the Environmental Protection Agency has recently begun a study of the nation's drinking water in order to ascertain if, indeed, carcinogens, those elements which cause cancer, are involved in the drinking water of our major cities. Major funding is going into this project and can be supported by each citizen by writing to Congress and to their congressmen, underlining the value of this work. There's a man among us who is shedding light on the effects of lighting on our consciousness. John Nash Ott, who has worked for years in the study of fluorescent and other lightings on the effects of school children, is in the Bay Area this month at Santa Cruz College. His work has included study of the value of full-spectrum plastic lenses and glasses so that ultraviolet rays enter the eyes for full health care in wearing of glasses. His work in the improvement of vision, study of X-rays and their effects as emitted from television and other areas are of major importance insofar as they relate our physical environment and our effects of our body on our consciousness. The work of another man, Dr. Frederick LeBoyer, is also gaining widespread acceptance and recognition. The number one health consideration for all of us is our birth, since that is our first encounter with the health establishment. And up to this point, birthing in the United States has indeed been considered along the same patterns as a disease. Dr. LeBoyer has created the method whereby the transition from the warm, dark, comforting womb is no longer so abrupt. He brings children out into a environment that's not bright lights, not loud sounds, and not slaps on the back. Instead, a warm bath, low lights, and quiet music. The work of Dr. LeBoyer is being supported in the Bay Area by a new institute, the Institute for Holistic Childbirth. Many medical practitioners are joining the effort to bring a new method of birthing into practice in the United States. Conscious birth control is receiving acceptance and recognition in the nation's press and publications. Luniception, that method whereby women note the cycles of their body in coordination with the cycles of the moon, as well as the older method, astrological birth control, are entering the picture now in order to offset the dire side effects of physical birth control methods, which have been used since the pill was originated in 1960. Biofeedback, bringing modern technology to bear on the problems of psychosomatic illnesses in society. Biofeedback employs such machines as the EEG and a galvanic skin response meter to help ordinary citizens, businessmen, and housewives reach deep states of relaxation, often sought after through methods of meditation and other contemplative techniques. Biofeedback is another example of how Western technology is joining the understandings of the East for the widespread raising of consciousness on the planet.
Listeners are invited to submit items for the Conscious News to New Dimensions Radio, 519 Montgomery Street, San Francisco, California, 94111. That's New Dimensions Radio, 519 Montgomery, San Francisco, California, 94111.
My earphones aren't working very well. I'm getting static and stuff like that.
And you're beginning to sniffle and you're beginning to break
down.
Well,
I picked the right show to do it on.
Well, of course you did. I told you. And every time we do a healing show, one of us just
disintegrates,
right? We've been joined by Khalid Al-Faqih of the Institute for Mystical and Parapsychological Studies of John F. Kennedy University, which has now moved into Orinda, which makes me very happy that it's at closer proximity to San Francisco, because I've seen the listings of the various programs that are offered there for a couple of years now, and have admired them greatly. I think they're really extraordinary, some of the most extraordinary in the Bay Area. And it makes me very happy to have it just over the hill. And it's very happy to have you here.
Yeah, thank you very much. We're a little lost with all the space we have now.
Oh, really? A bit of a change. Well, we don't suffer from that, as you sense here. All our shifting around. We're going to try later, perhaps, to get all of you in the studio at the same time. This round, Ralph Metzner is back with us, and Hillary Anderson and Kim McKell. And so maybe we'll have a slightly different focus this time around, and then we'll return to another mix.
Also, we're going to be taking phone calls in a little while, too, maybe 10, 15 minutes, so you might want to think about some questions, things that you'd like to share with our guest tonight.
Now, just exactly how, Khalid, you must have been listening to a great deal that was going on here, and you must have comments, so maybe we could begin with your particular view of what's been happening here.
Well, I've really enjoyed listening to the program, and sincerely, I think that the field of discussion has been covered very well, very eruditely by your previous guests, and in a sense, I really have nothing to add that wouldn't be saying the same thing in slightly different ways.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being with us, Kelly.
Can I have some more water before I leave? No, that kind of remark always prefaces about a one-hour monologue but, on what really wasn't. But I thought that one of the things that wasn't touched on was, except very briefly, was the effects of karma on the whole field of health. And karma being an expression of the balance of sanskaras, and sanskaras being mental impressions. Is not really fully understood, can't really explain the whole impact it has on health in terms of a single solitary existence. What we give our courses on healing and health at the Institute, we always start with the concept of karma, because I think it's important for people to think along the terms that a physical disease is a very convenient way of expending karma or impressions. There was a case of a reading, of a woman who had arthritis, crippling arthritis for about 15 years before she had this reading. And she was told that the karmic basis for this disease was due to an existence she had as a young, healthy, normal Blackfoot Indian back in the 1800s sometime. And as a Blackfoot Indian, she indulged in a certain amount of torture of her victims and what have you. And what happened was that she caused a lot of pain. And karmically, what had to be taught was what suffering really is. And rather than, let's say, she maybe tortured and killed 10 other humans, the law of karma superficially would say, well, you must be tortured and killed 10 times. But that's not very practical, considering that you could learn that lesson very well with an existence of as an arthritic. And crippling arthritis is a very painful and condition. So what it teaches is that what it teaches is the lesson of the results of one's actions, the opposites.
I can hear Irving in the other room saying, you're presuming cause and effect.
That's
again.
That's right. Well, I really had to appreciate the way he approaches the subject and thinks about it, but I think that the basis of cause and effect in karma is valid, at least to my way of thinking. And the reason for it is to achieve a balance. And it's much more practical to express some of these things in terms of physical existences, or pain is an extremely good teacher. So the thing is that until one breaks his bonds of karma, he's very likely to be a victim of various ills, both mental and physical. In other words, I don't think that one can ever achieve a state and maintain a state of perfect health as long as there's some unbalance in his impressions.
Some karma to work out.
Some karma to work out. It doesn't necessarily have to be a physical karma, but, for example, why should somebody... Is it just chance that a baby is born crippled or develops leukemia at a very early age? Casey did readings on several children with leukemia, and invariably it was some kind of symbology between the disorder in their blood and some past incident where blood had been shed as a result of their actions. That's one form of karma. It's called symbolic karma. There's another form that he defines as boomerang karma, such as one intentionally or non-intentionally blinding somebody would suffer the consequences by having some existence or some period of his existence being blinded. And there's another kind that he calls, I don't want to say orgastic, organistic, I suppose. For example, he points to somebody who had a problem of gluttony, in that he put an overemphasis on that particular sensual pleasure. And he didn't know how to control it, so karma intervenes and teaches him that control by giving him a hypersensitive digestive system. In this particular lifetime, when he asked Casey to read him, where the amount of food and the types of food he eats were very, very limited. And invariably, even the ones he could tolerate caused some discomfort. And
I know a personal friend of mine who had a situation quite similar to that. He for years had a problem with vomiting. He would vomit twice daily after every meal, and this went on for years, and he went on all kinds of diets and all kinds of therapy, and nothing worked until he had a reading and discovered that in a past life he had been grossly obese and overeaten tremendously. And so he took hold of that factor in his consciousness, and in that way was able to release it. And I wanted to mention a couple of other examples, if I might, that tie into what you were just saying. There's a marvelous series of lectures that was given several years ago in New York by an English homeopathic physician and astrologer by the name of Henry Davidson on the relationship of medicine and astrology. And he also was very aware of the reincarnational factor. He, for example, points out that many sufferers of muscular dystrophy were ones who in past lives were very much involved in a hunting existence where they damaged the muscles of animals, so that they're now experiencing muscular damage and muscular degeneration. He also points out an interesting thing about physicians, which is that he found out himself. He was giving lectures in the United States in Milwaukee, and I guess there are a lot of German immigrants in Milwaukee, and he was giving this lecture, and he tuned in at the lecture. A lot of the people that were asking the questions were former patients of his from a past life in which he had been a doctor in Germany, and these were patients that he hadn't cured. So if you're a doctor and you don't cure certain patients, they will come back in a subsequent lifetime. You'll get another crack at them.
That's why you're in a hurry.
And then I'd like to mention, there's a fantastic book called Many Lifetimes, written by Joan Grant, who is a woman who has the ability to remember her past lives in great detail, and has written about 7 posthumous autobiographies. And she wrote this book, which is a more therapy-oriented book, with her husband, who is a psychiatrist, who uses hypnotic therapeutic regression, both into childhood and then into past lives, when it's indicated. Now, it's not always indicated, and they wouldn't claim that there's always a past cause, but this book is filled with a whole series of cases that they have been able to very dramatically solve by going into past lives. And one was very interesting because this was a friend of theirs, also a physician, who came to visit them,
And when this friend left, the couple had a pheasant that they wanted to give him as a going away present. So they pressed this bird on him, and he said, no, don't give me a bird. I got a thing about birds. You know, I really can't stand to be near this or any other kind of bird. And so they both said, well, I mean, really, you've got to get over this. What is this? You know, so lie down on the couch, and the hypnotist started regressing him back, and he immediately almost spontaneously plunged into a past life scene where he had been on a battlefield and had died on the battlefield, but and had been was wounded and was then left on the battlefield without being fully dead, and then vultures had come and hacked him to death. So and this image of the this memory image of the vultures coming at him, you know, these bird thing that hacking him to death really had set up a thing in his consciousness, as it would, you know, he can really get into that. But the interesting thing was that Joan Grant tuned into his life too and found out what had happened, because the reason that it stuck was not because he had been hacked to death by vultures, because that's probably wasn't that uncommon. But the thing that had held it in was the fact that he, in this band of soldiers that they were in, they had the agreement that if somebody was seriously wounded, that his friends would kill him, so he wouldn't have to die like that. And he felt that thought that his friends had abandoned him and left him there without, you know, killing him. And so he was in a rage, a state of rage and fury at his friends, and it was the rage that held it in consciousness. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the fact of the vultures, it was the rage. So when Joan Grant tuned in, and she tuned into the consciousness of her friends and said, your friends did not abandon you. They thought you were dead. They didn't realize that you were still alive. So at that moment, he was then able to forgive his friends and see that it had been a misunderstanding, an honest mistake, and not a deliberate abandonment on their part. As soon as he was able to do that, the whole thing released, and he was able to take the bird home with him and eat it. So, you know, which...